Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Has Stranger Things' epic fourth season surpassed Korean phenomenon Squid Game on Netflix? And what else is trending in the world of streaming? I'm Art Chang, and this is your Daily Charge. With me to discuss all things streaming is our media expert and Daily Charge regular, Joan Salzman. Welcome, Joan.
Hi, Roger.
So Stranger Things has been a monster hit for Netflix, but is it the biggest hit of all time for the streaming service?
No, at least according to Netflix. The caveat of a lot of this conversation will be around, according to Netflix, which, you know, it's not like they open up their books and let anyone come in and vet all their data. But according to Netflix, by the way they measure popularity, what makes something a hit, it's by most hours watched within, and even this is a little bit debatable, within 28 days that something comes out, within about a month, 4 weeks of something coming out. And so Squid Game was just this like rocket ship that no one anticipated. It racked up 1.65 billion hours in its first 4 weeks. And Stranger Things season 4 racked up 1.35 billion hours. So it's pretty much exactly 300,000 hours less of fewer hours than Squid Game. But like a thing to keep in mind is, of course, you know, Squid Game has only had one season. Stranger Things is on its fourth. And so not only was this the most popular Stranger Things season so far, Stranger Things 3 had over half a billion hours watched. Stranger Things 2 had nearly half a billion hours watched. So in terms of just like, if you're going just by seasons, which is how Netflix likes to quantify it, Squid Games is still its biggest hit ever. But Stranger Things came reasonably close, much closer than anything else has come before.
Well, it's fascinating that Squid Game actually ended up hanging on, because it did come out of nowhere, and there was no built-in audience like there was for Stranger Things, right? Like it truly was sort of a surprise phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely. And it speaks to kind of the ability of Netflix to create a truly global phenomenon. But, you know, it also speaks to simply the fact that if we're just talking about Squid Game and Stranger Things, it speaks to the fact that Netflix, you know, today has a much more global audience and simply just has more eyeballs at the ready to watch something that's released now than when the first Stranger Things season was released in 2016. I think it's kind of fair to say that in 2016, Stranger Things, that first season, was perhaps as viral of a hit as Squid Game was. You know, it came out of nowhere. No one expected that the Duffer brothers would create what becomes like basically the only thing to rival Game of Thrones in terms of like worldwide popularity and interest. But, you know, in 2016, when that came out, Netflix had 94 million streaming subscribers. At the end of last year, around the time of Squid Game, Netflix had nearly 222 million subscribers, like well more than double. So there's just more people in a wider variety of places on this planet that can watch something that's popular on Netflix.
Yeah, it seems like, speaking to the idea of like the data kind of being a little squishy, I mean, basically the playing field keeps changing if the subscriber base keeps growing, right? Like, it's hard to make those apples to apples comparisons from just a few years back.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Before, I wanted to discuss some of the other shows and streaming services, but I also wanted to talk about Netflix's movies, because I know the data comes out there. It might be too early, but obviously The Gray Man just came out, and that was this action thriller from the Russo brothers, best known from the Avengers movies. The thing reportedly cost $200 million to make. It's this big action thriller with Chris Evans and, oh crap, now I forget the main character's name. The main actor's name. But I mean, it was this big thing, and I'm curious if there was any indication of how it's done, or is it still just too soon for that?
Well, yeah. We know. So the way that Netflix releases its viewership data, they do it for the previous week on a Tuesday for the week that ended Sunday. And so far we have some data on how popular Gray Man has been globally so far. It's only 10 days worth of data. Given the calendar, the timeline that Netflix reset. But so far, Gray Man has about 185 million hours of viewing in like 10 days on Netflix, which is good enough for the movie to be sort of just shy of entering the top 10 ranking of Netflix's most popular movies. One thing that I haven't seen, and partly, you know, this is an anecdotal way of gauging it, because on social media, everyone sort of lives within silos of interest and, you know, some things that people that nobody's talking about in my feeds might be hugely discussed in somebody else's algorithmic feed. But, you know, I so far haven't seen a ton of the kind of like cross-cultural buzz that you saw with like a Bird Box when that came out, when you had like all these like memes across different platforms around it. And I think like that was, I haven't seen that yet with The Gray Man, but, you know, Netflix has said they want to make The Gray Man its next sort of, you know, capital letter franchise. So, you know, there's a lot of levers and things at work about why they would make that decision. But at the core, Netflix generally doesn't make a repeated big bet on something if they don't have data to back up the fact that it's worth that bet. Especially right now, they're a lot more risk averse about investing. But, you know, like the way that they're being risk averse about what they invest in kind of works to the advantage of big franchise films and not to the advantage of having sort of like a greater diversity of smaller films that they're willing to take risks on.
Right, right. And then just to clarify, Ryan Gosling is the actor's name, who I forgot, who I guess is the Gray Man. I haven't seen the movie. but yeah, to your point, I mean, obviously the Russo brothers, huge cachet there. That's probably why they're able to justify that to $200 million. I'm assuming at that price tag, Netflix, yeah, is almost like committed to building out some sort of franchise for this film.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's possible that if they already put, like, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound, and that penny was $200 million. Yeah. I mean, that's possible. You know, and they've also built some, they've kind of flirted with this idea of building out franchises around some other movies, like the, what was it called? The movie about, like, the Las Vegas zombie casino heist movie
Heist of the Dead, Something of the Dead.
Yeah,
right?
It was like, yeah, something. I'll look it up while we're talking. After I'm finished talking, I'll look up the actual title.
It was a Zack Snyder project. I remember that.
I believe so, yeah. So like that came out and that was a popular movie. It's not popular enough to make this sort of top 10 list. Actually, let me see. Army of the Dead.
Army of the Dead.
Was
okay,
that it?
Yes.
Was it?
Well, there was a spinoff of that later on. Army of Thieves.
Yes. Right. Yeah. So, the Army of the Dead was the heist movie set in a zombie apocalypse, and that it was very popular. It's at about, you know, in a month, it had 187 hours, which is about what Gray Man is at in 10 days. But you know, that was popularity sufficient enough for Netflix to, yeah, sort of like greenlight us sort of a bit of a spinoff from that universe. And in that case, like you said, with Zack Snyder being involved, it also was a way to, you know, engender a continuing relationship with a very high profile filmmaker. There's definitely, you know, they've in the past done similar things before, but when they talked about Army of the Dead, they didn't talk about it. Well, they didn't telegraph anything like around this language around how we're building this to be our next franchise,
right,
sort
right.
of. Thing, and you're getting a bit more of a sense of that around Gray Man.
Okay. Speaking of fiscally prudent, wanted to bring up the news of Warner Brothers axing Batgirl, which I guess was supposed to be released via HBO Max, the streaming service, as opposed to theater. I'm not entirely sure if that's the case. They reportedly spent up to $90 million on this thing, and now they're just like killing it? Are you shocked? What happened here?
I mean, the big thing that happened, the sort of epochal change, is that the DC Universe films and HBO and HBO Max are all Warner Brothers companies. And Warner Brothers and Discovery, a different, you know, Discovery is the company behind Food Network and Food Network and the Nature Channel and the Discovery Channel. A bunch of reality and nonfiction, what they call nonfiction program. Those two companies merged, and the leader of Discovery became the overarching head of both companies. So the person that doesn't have the experience or the precedent in the kind of DC Universe, big franchise film, high-end, high-prestige HBO Max programming world, that's the person that's making the buck stops at David Zaslav about making the decisions in that world of either prestige TV or, you know, giant blockbuster big budget movies based on a comic book franchise. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that Zaslav would make this kind of move, just because he's famously cheap. And I don't mean cheap that's why Discovery was so successful, is it only invested in content that would get widely watched, be hugely popular, but wouldn't cost, you know, a ton of money. They didn't make these sort of tentpole giant budget bets that have paid off for Marvel, but haven't paid off in the DC universe of films. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that with the spotty track record that the DC universe of films has had, that it would shake things up and try to sort of install a new era by making some real drastic, off with her head sort of decisions, you know?
Yeah, this one definitely seems pretty dramatic given, I mean, the reports say that the filming had been done, although I think there's still some post-production work required, but the film was essentially shot.
The other thing to consider is that with these big blockbusters, the budget doesn't include the marketing investment that you have to put into one of these films. And so if a movie, you know, if Batgirl were to have a theatrical release, a theatrical exclusive release, the budget for the movie was 70 million or 90 million or whatever it was. But that doesn't encompass the other tens of millions that are kind of par for the course if you want to market a movie like that to actually be a blockbuster. And even if you do that, DC does not have the track record of delivering blockbuster status, even when they do pour all that marketing investment into one of its movies.
Yeah. Just shocking. Just broke yesterday morning. Curious, just looking elsewhere around the streaming service world, and looking at Disney Plus in particular, obviously, Disney kind of shot out of the gate with The Mandalorian. I'm curious if there are any other shows that sort of match that kind of level of virality.
On Disney Plus?
Disney Plus or I guess elsewhere, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole cottage industry that's sort of cropped up trying to figure out these questions of Mandalorian's a hit, right? Is it a hit? It is. Okay, yeah, it's a hit. And here's how we know from four different ways of looking at it, because we don't really know what a hit is anymore, and we don't really all agree on how you define it. But Mandalorian, by any marker, really, everyone knows that Mandalorian was a big phenomenon. Baby Yoda, by virtue of the popularity of Baby Yoda alone, you knew that it was getting through the cultural zeitgeist. And if you look at other stuff on Disney Plus, the sort of Marvel Universe, Disney Plus series have been doing really well. You know, the WandaVision was very popular. That was the first one that they had. I believe Loki, as far as I know, I haven't checked the numbers recently. As far as I know, Loki has been, I think, singularly the most well-watched of them. But all of them have been doing very well. There have been, you know, some other Star Wars, you know, Mandalorian is obviously Star Wars universe, and there have been some other attempts to kind of, for Disney Plus to sort of leverage Star Wars on its streaming service that haven't really panned out so well. But we do have some, you know, or I think we're still waiting for some data on, what was it, the Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan just finished its run when, like, within the last month. Part of the reason is there's delay. Like, Nielsen does measure, you know, it's the gold standard for regular TV measurement. Nielsen does release some streaming ratings, but I believe they're on a one-month delay of when the things air, because their business is giving the actual streaming services this data before it gives the public this data. So I think there's like a delay. I'll have to check the numbers for how Obi-Wan did. And then we have Andor coming up, which I think a lot of people are really interested to see what that's like.
Yep. Yep. And that's based on that character from Star Wars Rogue One. You have, I mean, just based on the number of explainers, streaming explainers you have an encyclopedic knowledge of what shows are streaming when and why and all that. I'm just curious from a personal recommendation perspective, anything you're watching that might be a little bit under the radar that you think more people should be watching?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. And the problem is, like, I don't know about you, but my we've lived through a pandemic brain, I can't recall those things off the top of my head. Honestly, I'm trying to think of things that I've watched recently that I was like, oh, this is great. Nothing's coming to mind. What about you, though? Do you have some? You share with our listeners.
Confession, most of the content I now consume is of like the TikTok, YouTube short, or Instagram reel variety. So like if the video is longer than 30 seconds, I've probably lost interest. But I would say I did enjoy the last season of The Boys. That was like the last proper, I think, series that I watched. Season of a series that I watched. And I thought that was pretty good. But that's not really under the radar. I think a lot of people are aware of that show. So not a great.
Yeah,
not a great
it's tip. One of Amazon Prime's most popular. Yeah. Most popular exactly. shows for sure.
Well, Joan, thanks for your time. It's been particularly fitting for you to be on since you've been such a key contributor to this podcast, especially back when it was known as the 359, the original form, a 4-minute long audio podcast. I wanted to announce today that this is the penultimate episode before my producer, Brian Van Gelder, and I take a much deserved break after 6 years of doing these daily podcasts. It's been an amazing run, Joan. I want to thank you in particular for all the times you hosted, pitched in, and helped plan and conceive that really ambitious but probably exhausting 4-hour-long episode of the 359 back in the day.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about that. The 3-hour and 3 hours and 59 podcast. Minutes
That we went straight in a marathon session. Those were good times. There was the 360 episode that Brian, I think, still kicks himself for trying to pull together. It did work. Yeah. Which we shot outside.
Was
Massa
that the
Square
one
Park.
That we shot with a 360 camera?
Yes, in out of Massa Square Park.
Right. Oh yeah, I remember that. That was fun. I think we got Shake Shack afterwards, and so that was the highlight of that podcast, getting Shake Shack together.
We did.
Well, that was kind of the best thing about this podcast, especially in its earlier form. I've definitely enjoyed coming to contribute as the Daily Charge, in the form of you as sort of like solo host and me and a lot of other people coming on as guests. But the fun part about the Daily Charge when it was the 359 and when it was the Daily Charge with multiple hosts was that it kind of felt like just like coworkers who are friends getting to like just talk with each other, which was really fun because I really enjoy talking with you and the past hosts. I love our conversations. And so it was really fun to be able to share those conversations with a group of listeners too.
Yes, absolutely. Especially when the show was in its YouTube live form and we were taking Q&A questions live. Yeah. That was nice. It was fun. It's been a really great run. We have one last episode tomorrow, which will include a special guest that I won't spill here, but it will be a fun one. We'll be looking back a lot. Hoping Brian will chip in. But stay tuned till tomorrow. And then after that, be sure to follow me at Roger W. Chang for updates on our future plans. For the Daily Charge, I'm Roger Chang. Thanks for listening.